Why go to all the trouble of experiencing the great outdoors for yourself when you can listen to a few Northwest Outdoor experts yap about it? This is The Outdoor Line with Tom Nelson, Rob Ensley, and Joey Pyburn on 710 ESPN Seattle and the 710 ESPN Seattle app. The Outdoor Line is brought to you by Yamaha, Sportco Outdoor Emporium, Lowrance, Weldcraft, and Duckworth Boats, Roy Robinson Chevrolet, Kitsap Marina, Harbor Marine, Truck Vault, and Ray Marine Electronics.
Hello, good morning, and welcome to the Outdoor Line on 710 ESPN Seattle, streaming live on MyNorthWest.com. And don't forget about the venerable TheOutdoorLine.com with blogs, videos, podcasts, and so very, very much more. Good morning, Rob Ensley.
Good morning, guys. How are we doing?
There we go. There he is. Joe Pyburn.
Good morning.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm a little stressed out.
Joey,
it's so busy.
Joey's trying to cram 2 weeks of work into into 2 days,
I will be seeing Robbo in person on Monday, which is awesome. I'm excited. Go chase bears.
Yeah, I'm fired up.
Do a little fishing.
Yeah. Go chase some bears up here. Do a little fishing. That's somebody's birthday today. Tom. Don't you point
what?
The camera towards Tom. Tom, you do not
what?
Look a day over 75. But
thank
it is
you
your
so much.
Today.
Your kindness is only exceeded by your extreme galoot height.
Happy birthday, big guy.
Yeah,
well, we got
yeah,
a show to do here, and the text toy is open too. 710-710, powered by Yamaha Outboards. You can text Tom a happy birthday wish this morning on the text toy, 625. Petra Hilleberg's going to jump on with us. It's their 50th anniversary at Hilleberg Tents, probably the best tent on the planet, at least if you ask Joe and I. They make some
bomb-proof
cool tents. And Petra's the captain of the ship over there. She's going to jump on 625 here in just a little bit, talk about their historic run here and what they got going on over at Hilleberg. They're based right in Washington there. At least their North American headquarters is. And we're excited to have her on the radio show here this morning. Tom, so you were... Let's see, you were 15 when Hilleberg started? How old are you? 10 years old.
Ow.
10
you're
years old.
Giving me the 75-year-old call. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I appreciate that, dude. Yeah. Dude,
Seven o'clock. We got this guy, Ezra Kaplan, on. He landed a 323-pound halibut. In the east, somewhere in the eastern Strait of Juan de Fuca, we're going to leave the location off the air here, but a monster halibut in the eastern Strait, 7 o'clock, he's going to jump on and talk about what it was like to crank up that behemoth from the deeps of the Strait of Juan de Fuca. Ezra Kaplan, 7 o'clock, 7:25, Joe Roeder, Rev's Fly Shop, they've got the rendezvous coming up here, June 11th through the 13th. Over at Red's Fly Shop. And part of that this year is this new 25 on the fly scavenger hunt, which is super cool. He told me about this a couple months ago, and I was like, dang, dude, that sounds like a lot of fun. I wish I was there to participate in that. But he's going to jump on and talk about this scavenger hunt, which is going to be a total blast. If you're into fly fishing, into any of that stuff, you want to check this out because it'd be a great weekend to head over with the wife or the kids or whatever and participate in that deal over at Red's Rendezvous. So Joe Roeder, 7:25, middle of 7 o'clock hour.
It's always funny setting up an interview with Red's Fly Shop because, you know, Robbo, you and I were over there. We actually did a show from over there a couple of years ago, and it's fun. The Steve Joyce, Joe Roeder hit the ping pong ball back and forth. One of them's going to do the show, but we don't know.
Yeah,
so the interview changed between back and forth, and it cracks me up talking to these guys on the phone because they sound exactly the same. You know, I just wonder if Joe Roeder has a personality disorder and he is Steve Joyce, you know, one of the two, right? And they just kind of work together. But I have seen him at the same place at the same time. But the thing of it is, it's really starting to kick off over there now. They get the first couple good warm waves, and they get 18 different bug hatches going on, and you know
they got the life over there,
dude.
Man.
It's so cool.
I talked
cool.
to him yesterday, and he's
it's
like,
"It's just a little
oh,
slice of Montana."
I was mountain
man.
Biking
Beautiful.
This morning, rowing down the river today, catching trout, fly fishing.
Yeah,
and it's like Montana.
And then you know, cycling back a little bit to Ezra Kaplan. I mean, you've seen this picture if you're a fish ding dong like we are. You saw this picture of this huge halibut being held up by a
little mini tractor.
Yeah, a little mini tractor deal, right? And so when, you know, Robbo, you kind of gave me the measurement of it, and I pulled it up online. What I did was I had an International Pacific Halibut Commission just weight deal on there, and I didn't have the live weight. And so I wasn't that excited about it, right? I thought, okay, all right, you know. But then I pulled up, you know, 80 F&G halibut size chart by length, okay? And like you pointed out, an 84-inch halibut is pushing 330 pounds, okay? Yeah. Having been at one time in my life 330 pounds, I know that's a lot of meat, okay? All right? But it's just, that is, without question, the biggest halibut that I've heard sport caught on the coast anywhere in years. And I'm not just talking Washington, Oregon, okay, British Columbia. I'm talking Alaska. I don't recall in recent years somebody whacking a 330 around here.
Yeah, at least in Washington. The state record, I think, is 288 pounds, if I recall correctly. But, yeah, we'll have him on at 7 o'clock, talk about his big catch. Also, tomorrow is the halibut opener out of Westport. They got blown out on Thursday. Talked to Mark Coleman from All Rivers and Saltwater Charters yesterday. He's like, yeah, they closed us out. Thursday was just blowing too hard off the coast. But he was excited about tomorrow. Figures, you know, the first day of halibut fishing off the coast should be excellent, and they're getting geared up for that, and deep water lingcod too off the coast, which should be a fun expedition out there. God, we got trout fishing, walleye. I talked to Shelby Ross last night over on Potholes. They're just crushing the walleye over Potholes and Moses Lake too, for that matter. You could fish walleye in the morning, bass in the afternoon, or vice versa. I mean, it is just, they're just hitting all gears over there on those lakes right now in that neck of the woods. Bass fishing, Northwest Bass, there's a tournament coming up June 5th over on Moses Lake if you want to get signed up for one of those fun tournaments. But again, the bass fishing right now is crazy too for you guys down there. Lingcod, decent tides today, not great, but decent for the Sound. Joe, you and I were talking a couple days ago. There's been a ton of lingcod coming out of the San Juans and North Puget Sound there. It looks like it's been pretty darn good.
Yeah, we had some nice tides for guys getting out during the week, and I had some buddies out there, and yeah, the fishing was great. You know, that opening set of tides was so strong that I don't think a lot of the fish got sucked up. So there's a ton of lingcod still out there. Guys are doing great.
As the tides soften, I mean, I've talked to a lot of good sticks that are going out, finding their live bait, and dropping it, and coming home with dinner.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. And you know, the guys that, like you pointed out, that know what they're doing, you know, will get them on those extreme tides that we had during the opener. But it really didn't give anybody an accurate look at the fishery at that time because it was so challenging.
Well, and
right?
There's been a ton of, like, 20 to 23-inch lings, you know? Like, so
just
undersized. I think that bodes well for next year.
100%.
I mean, those fish are going to be in the slot limit, you know, in the mid slot limit range. Probably they grow pretty fast. So
yeah, no question.
Yeah, just tons of ling out there.
No question about it. And you know, like you indicated, Robbo, the opener, the ocean halibut opener here on Thursday was basically a non-event. I mean, you had just, you know, tremendous gale winds. It basically kept the whole fleet. A few guys did venture out, but it wasn't anything, you know, like what had been happening inside in Puget Sound. And that's a really unusual thing to say, that a lot of guys on our inner Puget Sound opener, you know, it was a pretty solid opener, and the ocean opener just was a non-event. But I really expect that to flip as the weather moderates. And on this set of tides, it plays right into a lot of ocean halibut fishermen.
Well, they'll get their days.
They will.
They
100%.
They just have, you know, they have way more weather to deal with out there.
Boy,
than we have in here.
You said a mouthful. And with the current closure going on still in Nia Bay and La Push, you know, it's more of a challenge to get to the real meat of our halibut, coastal halibut grounds here in Washington.
Also got shrimp opener coming up May 19th. And I think after the break, Nelly, I want to run through rigging up an SMI pot with you.
Oh, let's do
because
that.
Because they make it so easy. Let's start
they
with
do.
The pot and run all the way up to the buoys, through the sea links and everything, and then how you store your line. Some bait tricks for folks, because people are going to be running around this weekend getting their pots ready and getting everything ready. It's a midweek opener. It's a Wednesday opener. So you need to have everything dialed in. So you can shoot out there. You might even just be able to take the morning off from work and get out there and get some shrimp and shoot back, or you can just call in sick and take the whole day off. But yeah. We got to get you dialed in here. So
you know, after you do get those shrimp, you should like start eating.
We know.
Which would definitely take the rest of the day.
We know what the answer to that question is. I just threw it out there anyways, but we already know what's going to happen. So
no question about it. So tell you what, let's pop out here quick. Let's do that. And then of course next week we're going to have Bub on the show, Bob Buchanan, to kind of, you know, walk us through some of that stuff. But a couple things we need to think about to be effective, you know, shrimp fishermen from lines and everything. And Joey, you and I have pulled enough rope to have a clue about this. So tell you what, give us 90 seconds. We're going to be right back. Load up that text toy 710-710 powered by Yamaha Outboards. Right back here on the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN, Seattle.
From the shining shores of Puget Sound to your radio, this is the Outdoor Line on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Welcome back to the Outdoor Line. I'm Tom Nelson. That's Joey Piber and Rob Ensley coming at us remotely on a little tiny screen. We can see him. He's coming at us from Craig, Alaska, and I actually I'm flying in the morning to Sitka, and you're gonna fly and join Rob up there and go. Go in search of the large beach bears, okay? Black beach bears in Southeast. That brand new 6.8 Western from Browning may get a little work.
It's all dialed in and gutter all sighted in last week. Pretty impressive, man. That's a big projectile that's coming out of that thing. You know, 175 grains coming out of there, almost at just under 3,000 feet per second. And I sent Robbo, I videoed the first shot like 5 feet away from me just so he could kind of see the kick on it. And that gun barely jumps, right, Rob? I mean, it barely kicks. It's like shooting my 6.5 PRC.
Yeah. And since
I was expecting a little more punch out of it, but man, smooth shooter. I shot three shots. My first shot was 8 inches to the right, did a little dialing, then I was about 3 inches to the right, and then I FaceTimed Robbo. My third shot was in the bullseye at 100 yards. How easy is it to sight this thing in, man? I remember back in the day sighting in rifles, and you're like,
all over the place,
spraying bullets all over the place. I was like, okay, three shots. She's in the red.
That's a little glimpse in the. Total knuckleheadedness of what we do. Hey, watch me shoot my gun. I'm going to turn my phone on Facebook. Yeah. Watch this. But no, that is absolutely.
And our conversations revolve around twist rates and, you know, ballistic coefficients and not like stock market or
not anything productive. No.
Bitcoin anything productive. Yeah.
And you know, that's what makes that round perform so well is the ballistic coefficient of that bullet. Those bullets are designed to slice through the air, and they call it, you know, they're slippery, man. They cut through the air, less resistance, and those bullets do all the work, man. They just incredible stuff.
Well, for years we've been shooting guns that.
Sorry, Tom, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but when you get over like that 2,900 feet per second, that's when the violence starts on your shoulder. You know, and most of the stuff we shoot is 3,300. I mean, my 300 Winchester short mag gets 3,300 feet a second, and it just kicks the crap out of you. Now, most of the rifles nowadays actually come with a muzzle brake. It used to be you had to bring it to a shop, have a muzzle brake installed, but most of the magnums nowadays come with a muzzle brake, which really helps. It cuts it about in half, but still, you still get that violent kick. But this thing, it's got a muzzle brake. It doesn't hardly kick to begin with, so it's just like it's a dream to shoot. I'm going to take mine out to the range here in Craig tomorrow and just make sure it's still on paper and make sure it's still shooting good. But yeah, they're sweet, man. I'm looking forward to getting them out and actually hunting with them a little bit. So
yeah, they've come so far, and you said that they're a pleasure to shoot. You take my 300 Win Mag out, and it's going to wreck your shoulder. And there's things that come from that, and it's a flinch. And I'll be the first to admit, you know, I'm not a small guy, and when that 300 Win Mag is gonna hit you, you can't help but cringe a little bit. And that's what the PRCs. Yeah. And the 6.8 Western have done. They've, you know, they use that rocket science thing to get you squared up. We are going to have Bob Buchanan on the show next week. He is you know, our shellfish, our pot wizard, right? Of course, Bomac is behind so much stuff, including that SMI line coiler. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm going to start in this discussion of shrimp gear for the upcoming opener, because we have such a limited opportunity time-wise and a limited amount of days here in Puget Sound. We're going to be lucky if we get 2 days, but then you're going to have an opportunity in the Straits. So you don't have time to mess around. If you've got 400 feet of line in a shot, the gremlins have gotten into that over the winter and tied 18 different kind of knots, none of which have been recognized by line manufacturers in the course of history. Okay? Seriously. I don't know what happens with that stuff. And so it was striking to me, because I'm sending some shrimp lines and stuff up north, that here they are. They're all on a coil. Okay?
Yeah.
And they come out fast. And it's just that level of organization that gets you that much farther down the line. But setting up these pots, Robbo, to your point, you know, I start with a fast fishing SMI pot. So what I mean by that is you can get the stackable pots that are mesh and conical in shape that have very limited entry openings. Mm-hmm. Now, that's great, because once those prawns get in there, it's a one-way ticket. They have a very difficult time finding their way out. However, it's finding their way in that's going to delay it. In a short period of openings, I like the square pots here in Puget Sound with an adequate amount of weight. And when I adequate, dude, you need to throw probably at least 10, preferably 15 or 20 pounds in there. And that's easy to do. You can zip tie a downrigger ball to either side. But what I like is Bomax coated weights that will put, they're square and they're easy to attach.
And they kind of slide underneath the ramps.
Yes.
Right. So they're tucked away. They're not going to impede the shrimp from getting in there.
100%.
And yeah, you want to make sure you weight your pots. If you don't weight your pots, you're going to lose your gear.
Oh, 100%.
They're going to get blown off the edge and end up in 600 feet of water, and they're gone.
Because that's what you said there. You said a mouthful, because you know, it's not only indicative of what you need to do, but it also is very descriptive of the habitat in which you want to. You're not going to find shrimp on the flats.
Mm-hmm.
You find them on the slopes. And if you're fishing slopes, which are going to be rocky, you're going to be harder. That's more prawn habitat down there. And you miss, okay, or your pot walks, you're going to lose your pot. Mm-hmm. You're not going to find prawns on flats like you do crab. They're two different critters and two different strategies out there getting their job done. Okay, so also, let's put harnesses on these pots and not just tie them to one corner. Like, we can get away with that on crab gear, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm trying to do here, is break a lot of, I'll say, crabbing bad habits, right? Because you can tie a crab pot to one location on there and pull it up. Those crab are not going to work their way out of there. But if you dump a shrimp pot sideways like that with the larger openings that I'm talking about in SMI or Bomax
now
square
pots. Now you're
losing
food.
Yes, you are.
You're losing your dinner.
You're
your
losing
dinner.
Them. And also the speed at which you can retrieve that gear is going to not only, you know, get you your pots up faster, but the water pressure of a pot being hauled parallel to the surface of the water is going to keep those little suckers glued.
It pins them to the bottom of the pot.
It does. Yeah. It's that damn gravity thing.
The nice thing about those SMIs, they've got attachment points, and he sells a harness, and all you do is flip it in. There's no tying four bowling knots around it and sitting there and monkeying with a bunch of making your own harness and stuff. You just buy the harness, and then you clip into the top of the harness, and it's so easy to build a system. So go ahead, Tom. Keep
Yeah,
keep
and then and then we will have not at all. No, it was a great point.
But
as far as bait, we're going to save that to next week, because we're going to have Bob Buchanan on next week, and he's going to discuss his methodology and the rate at which your bait should disappear.
So
suffice it to say, if all your bait is in your bait jug when you pull that shrimp pot,
you're not fishing.
You're not fishing well.
So, okay, we'll do bait. We'll do bait next week.
Yeah.
So you got your harness. How are you going to attach your line to your harness?
That's another great concept, and now you're talking about the ceilings.
Yeah.
Okay. So your SMI harness is going to have four big snaps. To the four big snaps, you're going to come up to, you know, it's basically a bridle or cradle. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's got four attachment points, and it comes up to a ring. You're going to take a little clevis and snap in an SMI C-link, because it is those C-links that make the SMI line coiler, okay, work, because you want to be able to take the floats off, you want to take the pot off, and then you just
and
have this line.
Easily detach your floats and your pots, and then you have your shot of line totally separate, tucked away.
So that a C-link.
C-link to C-link.
Yep.
And those C-links are like...
C-link to the ring, Yeah.
Yeah, they're the coolest little gadgets because they make it so easy.
They do.
I've seen pots before with the crazy, shoelace knot over and over and over,
dude.
And then duct taped, and then, you know, you're not getting that thing off
easy
at all.
No.
But so C-link to C-link, and then
your rope, your 400 to 500 foot rope just has.
If you're fishing here in the Puget Sound, you're 275, 300 feet, 325. How much line should guys have on those pots?
Just go with four. I don't want to see anybody out there shrimp fishing with less than 400 feet. There's no need to. Yeah. There's no need, and there's really very little advantage to not using that full 400-foot shot of line. Plus, it makes you more versatile, right? And if you think, oh, I'm going to drop this pot at 275 feet, and that's it. Yeah, okay, good luck hitting that. You know, it's even if your pot's weighted, there's going to be drift. That water column, even on a stand of a tide, is moving, okay? Mm-hmm. And it's never moving in a convenient location. Tides are rarely convenient. Would you agree? Would you agree with that, Robbo? Unless you really plan on tides, they're going to be less than convenient, right? So you're going to C-link both ends of this 400-foot line. Then you make off an adequate amount of floats to the other one. And that's what I store in the pot, are actually the floats. And then the lines will stay stowed. On that SMI BOMAC, SMI coiler. And that's just where they live. And that's just, it's an organized system that's going to make all the hassle and all the tangles and everything else go away. We will have Bob Buchanan on the show next week to kind of further break this down. But that's your shrimp opener.
If you want your shrimp fishing to be fun and easy and productive, that coiler is kind of key. I mean, especially for shrimping. Yeah. When you're dealing with 400 to 500 foot shots of line, it's always a mess.
You got to have a game plan.
Yeah,
you got to, and that SMI line coiler is definitely your game plan. All right, so I get to look at my two gnarly dude buddies here, Joe Pyburn and Rob Ensley, and last fall they were back in Montana, and I saw my gnarly dude buddies in this gnarly tent. Now tents have come a little way since Nelly here was a little Boy Scout, right? And there's a little Jerry surplus, Army surplus, green canvas freaking tent
that weighed 73 pounds.
Oh my goodness, dude! Those things were heavy, okay? And they weren't easy to put up, and they weren't warm, they weren't fun, and four drops of rain, and you were just as wet on the inside of that canvas duck as you were on the outside of it.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say, tent technology has come just a little bit, thanks to Hilleberg the tent maker. Is this weekend the 50th anniversary of Hilleberg, Robbo?
This week was, 50 years.
That is absolutely crazy.
Making the most bomber tents in the world.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, this interview is long overdue, no question about it. Stick around. Petra Hilleberg of Hilleberg Tents joining us next here in the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN, Seattle.
Welcome to the BOMAC Tech Line. BOMAC has all the gear for all your techniques, and SMI shellfish gear is simply the best. BOMAC, we catch big fish.
Well, suffice it to say, a lot of people's hunts start where the road ends, right? But if you're you kind of hunt out of an RV, hunt out of your rig, that's one thing. To really get back and get back to the critters, you got to pack home with you, and that means a tent. Not just a tent. Hilleberg, dude, you got to check out what they've got going on. They have become the standard by which all other shelter that you can carry has been measured.
Yeah, they're a bomb-proof shelter. I mean, I've been in a lot of tents in my lifetime, and Robbo and I had the experience of Hilleberg last year in Montana, where we had winds gusting up to, I don't know, maybe 45, 50 at some point, and we were inside the tent, and it was quiet. I mean, I've never experienced that. That tent is so tight, and we actually had it set up, you know, we didn't know which direction the wind was going to come from. We kind of had it set up sideways. Wind was pounding right into that thing, and we were just sitting there having a conversation. We're like, this is incredible. Yeah, amazing tents.
Yeah, absolutely, and amazingly tough, and then aerodynamic too. And again, if we had that tent set the correct direction with the wind there, the wind would have rolled right over that thing, and it would have been just a piece of cake. But do we have Petra there this morning? Is Petra with us? Are we still trying to get out to Petra?
No, I believe she's there. Petra Hilleberg, are you with us, my friend?
I am. Good morning.
Well, thank
Petra.
You.
Morning, Petra.
Thank you and welcome to the show.
And happy 50th anniversary to Hilleberg Tents there. In all your years at Hilleberg, have you ever seen a year as crazy as this last one as far as people getting into the outdoors and folks, the demand for your tents is just crazy right now. What's the view over at Hilleberg these days?
Well, thank you for the congratulations. Amazing. It's obviously been a rough year for everyone, so the reasons for it is obviously not great, but the demand is incredible, so that's obviously a good problem to have, but it's also a tricky problem to have to juggle with manufacturing and trying to make sure that to keep retailers happy and consumers happy, and it's a lot of juggling, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, and you mentioned manufacturing, Petra. That's what sets Hilleberg apart from all the other tents. You guys have your own manufacturing. You control everything. And you sold us on Hilleberg. Joe and I visited your office a year or two ago or something like that. And you had us do a tear test on fabrics in the office. And we could not tear the fabric on your tents.
Yeah.
Joe and I were pulling and
Joe,
you grab that side and I'll grab this side and I'll pull and we were stepping on them and putting our feet on them and doing whatever we could do to tear that stuff. And you couldn't do it without a knife. Just incredible. So maybe talk about the fabric you put into those tents and the whole manufacturing process and what makes them just so bomber.
Yeah. Well, so our main focus has always been to have something that is the highest quality that you possibly can get. And it's because we use the tents ourselves, our friends use them, and we want to make sure that people are safe. So we talk a lot about margin of safety in the different models. And the fabric is obviously kind of the main component of that. So basically what stands between you and the weather. And so we've chosen to have this fabric, we call it the Carillon fabric, of different levels depending on what models. But they're all really, really strong. And that's basic because any fabric is going to deteriorate over time. And, if you step on it or accidentally have, chip it with, air or anything that damages the outer tent fabric, you're not going to have to run the risk of it continuing to run and get a bigger tear. So that's why it's so important with that high tear strength. So that's kind of one of the main reasons why the tents are on the more valuable, as I like to call it, not expensive, but valuable side, that they cost a little bit more than others. It's because of that extra margin of safety that you get with that fabric. And then also, obviously, that we have our own factory in Europe where every tent is set up and checked. You even have a little name tag in the tents of who made it. And so it's just that quality aspect that we put into every single detail in the tents.
You know, Petra, so I do a lot of hunting, right? I mean, you make tents not just for hunters, for everybody. I see your tents all over the place when I'm in the backcountry, hikers and campers and, just people exploring outside. And all the gear that we use, it's all expensive, The thing about your guys' tents is you could buy a tent and you could have that tent for 20 years. I mean, if you take care of it, those tents are built to last. So really, when it comes down to it, you can go buy a cheap tent at Walmart or you can spend the money and buy a Hilleberg. And for me, I want to have the best equipment, and I don't really care what it costs. I know that tent, over the course of its lifetime, if I pay $500 for a tent and I get 10 years out of that tent, it's not that much. And your guys' tents are just built to last. They're amazing equipment.
Yeah, I think that the math is pretty simple if you do it over time.
It is.
We're seeing a lot more with hunters understanding that. I think that the appreciation for value is very different in the hunting world because when you're out, your whole hunt is dependent on the fact that you can stay out, so you don't have to go back in because your shelter broke, or that you can get a good night's sleep so that you can do everything that you want the next day. So I think that aspect is much more important. I think it's important for everyone, but the sticker shock is not in the front room like that, which is important.
Now, if you jump on Hilleberg.com, you'll notice that Hilleberg tents are broken into four categories, more labels, I guess I should say, black label, red label, yellow label, and blue label. Can you talk really quick for folks that might be jumping on the website and looking at some tents, the different categories and kind of what tents fall into each category there, Petra?
Yeah, it's kind of to help you navigate a little bit better. So the black and the red label are both all-season tents. So basically they work all year round. We like to talk about all-season rather than four-season because often four-season people just think winter and heavy. So the all-season tents, what we consider an all-season tent is obviously that it should be able to handle any weather year-round, easy to set up, strong materials, and also that all mesh panels can be covered up so you don't get snow or rain or wind or sand blowing into the inner tent, and also that the outer tent goes all the way down to the ground for the same reason. So that's the black and the red label. They're also the strongest. The black labels have our absolute strongest fabrics and poles. So if you're going somewhere where you need the highest safety margin because the weather that you encounter is going to be really unpredictable or very exposed, then the black label is a good idea. Red label is where most people live, so potential for snow, winter usage, all year round usage, still very, very strong, but some features are a little bit lighter compared to the black label. And then we have the yellow label, which is our technical three season, but we call them for the snow-free times of the year. So shoulder season, we do know that some people use them in the winter. They're going to be a little bit colder. You might, you have the potential for getting snow in, which is very, very unlikely and unusual, but they're lighter. So, for longer trips, some people prefer them. A lot of hunters prefer them because you carry a lot. As it is already, so having a light shelter. But again, you have a slightly lower safety margin compared to a black label or a red label, and then preferably not in the winter. It's not going to be as comfortable as some of the others. So it's kind of you compromise a little bit, but it's important to point out that we only compare within our own line. So we don't say, oh, this is not as strong as fill-in-the-blank model. It's only within our own line. And then the blue and the label are group tents. Yes.
So, Petra, one thing you mentioned, I want to make sure we get to this. You said they won't be as warm. So one thing that I'd never experienced before in a tent was how warm that was. Rob and I were sitting in there. So talk a little bit about how those tents are designed and how they hold the heat. Even we're in November in Montana and we're in there like, you know, in our long underwear just sitting around, and it actually got warm inside that tent. Talk a little bit about how you guys make those tents stay warm.
Well, so all the tents are double walled, and what we do differently is that the poles are on the outside of the outer tent. So when you set up the tent, everything goes up together, which is a huge feature that you don't have to worry about setting up the inner tent and then throwing the fly on top while everything gets wet. Everything goes up as one unit. So you have a completely waterproof and very strong outer tent, or fly as you would traditionally call it, so the outer tent. And then you have the inner tent, which is attached with shock cords and toggles. So those two layers obviously give some, they both protect from rain, weather, wind, condensation. So you have, and then the fact that you don't have wind or rain or snow coming in underneath the tent or through open vents. So you can bunker it down a lot more and close it with the fact that you can close those mesh panels on the red and black label. same thing in the summer, though. That's, they still work equally well in a Utah desert hunt because you can open it up. So it's just kind of how they are integrated with the two layers and the quality of those layers.
I guess the best way to describe it, it's almost a tent within a tent. And then, you know, we had the Kitem 4 GT. I mean, that tent just sucked right down to the ground. The outer part of that tent, we had it right on the ground, and it was so tight. We strung that sucker up as tight as we could get it. And you even mentioned to us at the office, like, you have to set this with the wind. Well, what did we do? We didn't know it was going to blow 40, 50 miles an hour. We set it sideways to the wind, and it was like the worst possible setup ever. And it was fine. Yeah. We said, well, so cool. You know, you bleep because the tent's flapping away. But it was just perfectly quiet inside that tent and comfortable. So anyway, that was our experience with that.
As long as they're set up well. I mean, as long as they're set up well. Obviously, you never know what the wind is going to do and how it's going to shift. So it's not that it's a problem if you set it up technically against the wind. But the tunnel tents are obviously depending on a good setup. So you guys obviously did a great job setting it up. So you have to make sure that you have a good stretch of the ridge line. Otherwise, it can flop around. So sometimes we see that if people set it up by pegging by the poles first. You want to peg kind of the back end and then lift it up and pull it out and then get the front end down and make sure that it's really tight over the ridge line. Then it can really handle any wind, really from any direction.
There's a big difference between your hunting starting when the road ends and your hunt starts where a comfortable tent is pitched. That's where you're going to find at Hilleberg.com. Petra, thank you very much for your time this morning. We appreciate it, and congratulations on entering your now sixth decade as making the industry standard best tent available, Hilleberg Tents. Thank you very much. We'll talk to you soon. Appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you,
Petra.
Thank you, Petra.
Have a great weekend. All right.
You too. Take care.
Take care.
All right, coming up next, Raymarine Picks of the Week here for the 8th of May. Hooray, hooray for the 8th of May. Right back here on the Outdoor Line, 710 ESPN Seattle.
Welcome to the Outdoor Line Picks of the Week, presented by Raymarine Electronics. Don't just go fishing, go hunting underwater. Raymarine, simply superior.
Log on to Raymarine.com. You're going to find the Raymarine Axiom Plus. Smarter, brighter, easier to operate ever. Also, Vessel View for Axiom is available in a variety of different outboard manufacturers. Go check it out. All that and more at raymarine.com. All right, here we are, stringing into the middle of May now. You know, we got Coastal Halibut. The opener, Coastal Halibut opener, was kind of a non-event on Thursday, but it doesn't start and stop there. We got a lot going on, Robbo.
Oh, for sure. Halibut opener tomorrow on the coast. As you mentioned, it was pretty much canceled Thursday because of wind. So now the opener is tomorrow. Also got Deepwater Link caught off the coast. You know, we've kind of been remiss in not talking about trout here a little bit. I mean, the trout opener was not too long ago, late April. Kind of opened with a big thud, poured down rain opening weekend. And so there's tons of trout in these local lakes all over the state right now. So definitely get out this weekend. I just pulled your weather for Seattle, and it looks decent this next week. You get up into the low 60s or whatever, good time to get out and get some trout. Walleye fishing on the east side has been on fire. Talked to Shelby Ross last night from Ross Outdoor Adventures over there and Potholes there. Potholes on fire. Moses Lake is going. I haven't got any purse from Banks Lake, but I guarantee there's some walleye coming out of Banks, too. It's just the perfect time of year to get on those walleye. They're just coming off the spawn. They're hungry. They're aggressive. Hammer time over there. Bass fishing, no-brainer right now. Smallies, largemouth. This next month and a half, are going to be just superb for bass. What else we got? We got lingcod fishing. Of course, that opened up a little while ago, but we got a decent tide this weekend for lingcod in the Sound. I think I saw a little bit of a kind of a semi-soaker flood this afternoon. Looked like about a 7-foot run. Just a decent tide for lings in the Sound. Shrimp opener coming up on the 19th. If you need to run around and get any gear this weekend, definitely get out there and get whatever gear you need right now. Get stocked up for that shrimp opener. Turkey hunting still going. Now, I don't have much experience, Joe, hunting turkeys this late in the season. What's that like? I mean, are they still going to respond to calling and that stuff, or is it more of a spot and stalk kind of a program right now, Joe?
No, it can actually be really good calling. A lot of, you know, a lot of guys like to be there for the opener, and then maybe they'll hunt that weekend, maybe one more, and then they, a lot of guys are done. So there's less pressure. But what happens is those hens now are moving to lay. They're on the nest, right? So they're not out cruising around. There's a bunch of toms out there frolicking around, looking for those hens, and all the hens
looking
are on the
love.
Nest. Looking for love.
Okay. And, like me some frolicking.
And the girls are all on the nest. So it can be really good. I mean, you know, those toms are still actively looking for hens, and they're not around. So, yeah, it can be really good late season, especially if the weather's nice on the east side. If they're having nice sunny days, those birds can stay active right up until the end of the season.
Yeah, perfect. And then your special hunt apps, you got till May 26th to get those in as well. So
great
good time
point.
To do some research, look at units. Now, a lot more people are applying to nowadays, and you got to keep that into consideration. But that shouldn't change the fact that you need to get your hunt, your special hunt apps in. You got till May 26th to get that stuff done. But lots going on. I think it'd definitely be fun. If we were home right now, we'd be probably trout fishing with the kids. That's super fun right now. And there's so many trout in the lakes. I mean, just jump on the WDFW website, get up in the search window there, search catchable trout plants, and then you can go county by county, lake by lake, region by region, whatever you want to do, and you can pull up all the lakes near you that have been planted, and they show you the size of the trout, everything else. A lot of the lakes, too, you can fish trout in the morning and then switch over to bass or panfish later in the day, because a lot of the lakes have all kinds of stuff in them. So good opportunity to get out and have a lot of fun.
The kokanee fishing's still been really good, too. Guys are roping some kokanee here in the local lakes. Lake Stevens has been really hot early in the morning, still in that top 20 feet of water. God's Tooth Spoons. A lot of guys are just running wedding rings, back to the old school wedding ring, shoe peg corn.
Does Lake Shannon kind of get going a little bit later, the kind of elevation, cooler temperature program up there? Because I know there's some bigger
seems like it
up in that neck of the woods, too. It sure seems like it, Rob. Remember the old days when the catch and release thing used to, catch release thing used to kind of slow down all those jet sleds that we were working next to in this gadget. You'd see them up on Lake Shannon up there doing the chumming
program.
Seems
like more of a June. It seemed like kind of a June program up there, didn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
And a different drill, a chumming, a lot of chumming.
Still fishing,
Tying off to a log boom or something, or anchoring up. And, yeah. Great program, though. Great camping. Incredible camping up there, too, around Lake Shannon.
I saw some guys get incapacitated one time while they were anchored. They stayed anchored with refreshments for too long, okay? that can definitely be a problem up there in the Skagit Valley, no question about it. Stay tuned. There's moonshine up there. There's moonshiners up there. I've seen them. All right, stay tuned for a jam-packed hour two. Ezra Kaplan, you've seen this picture floating around on social media, an honest, bona fide 84-inch flat one, okay?
Yeah, that would bring it in right at about 323 pounds.
That's a worthy offensive lineman right there, no question about it. Ezra joining us next, no question about it. The Northwest Outdoor Report brought to you by American Pacific Mortgage and Mark Dilschner of thehomeloanangler.com. Joe Roeder, here we go. We're going to get our trout fishing in with our buddy Joe Roeder, and spring on the Yakima River, and the 25 on the fly event. This is a really cool event he's going to tell us about. Roy Robbins is really rare and a lot more. Stay tuned for an absolute jam-packed hour two here on the Outdoor Line 710 ESPN Seattle.